some people ask me, what are the, what is the least assumption, the weakest assumption on the metrics for which you can say something about upper and lower bounds? Subgaussian or subexponential, you can go below like moment assumption. What are the assumptions of where you can estimate upper and lower bounds for any matrices? And this is the fourth moment of the entries. Fourth moment of the entries of A is the weakest assumption. Any meaningful information about the maximum and minimum. That the fourth moment is the weakest assumption under which you can say something was realized in the 80s. And the non-trivial part of this is that under this assumption you can actually say something in the other direction. And that is a non-trivial result of Latala about 2000 liters. That if you do have a fourth moment assumption on the entries, all the entries of the metrics, then the norm, then you can bound the norm C prime square root of that. C prime depends on C in a linear way. So the matrix is actually square root of n squared. So this is the weakest assumption. It doesn't tell you much about the probability, and it cannot tell you much about the probability because the fourth moment. Well, force is probability, it's really polynomial. Okay? Alright. Any questions? So the last part of this course is about random Fourier matrices. Their situation will be a little bit harder. This is the hardest of all cases. So I'll talk about how to sample frequencies of the signal, and how do we control the sampling. What is this corresponding central limit theorem or law of large number limit theorem probability theory that is needed to control such matrices. And that will connect us to the whole body in computational harmonic analysis, time frequency analysis, we'll go to frames, and the result that we learn, the tool that we learn is Rudolphson selection theory. All right, so how do you sample frequencies? Imagine that your measurements now are not multiplication by subgaussian matrix, but they are just frequencies of the signal. That's a basic problem in signal analysis, signal processing. We need to use some randomness, as usual, and we'll assume that our measurements are random frequencies for the signal. So the whole set of frequencies forms a discrete Fourier transform. If you apply the DFT matrix, which has these entries to your signal, you're going to get the vector of all of the d frequencies, discrete frequencies of this signal. So in what we'll learn today, it will be the specific form of the DFT matrix will be completely irrelevant. What we'll actually use, only thing that we'll use is that the DFT matrix is an orthogonal matrix, and its entries are bounded in absolute value in the modulus by 1 divided by the square root of n. That's the only two assumptions needed about the matrix. So you can use arbitrary matrix. It would be hard to use waivers though, because they are compact and supportive. So the discrete Fourier transform of f will be written as f hat, and this is a multiplication by the DFT measures. And if we do not need the whole Fourier transform, all of the frequencies, but just use few of them, this will amount to take some rows of the DFT measures. So the measurements of the signal f are the capital N random frequencies taken from a random set omega. Omega is a random subset of all the frequencies. Sample random frequencies. And as a consequence, our measurement matrix will be a collection of rows, a sub-matrix, a minor of the DFT matrix. Collection of the rows which correspond to the set omega. For simplicity, it's shown as an integral, but it's not necessarily just random subset of what is it called, rows. So these are the measurements. And then we got a Fourier reconstruction problem, which asks whether we can reconstruct any sparse signal from few Fourier measurements, from few frequencies. Namely, if we get a signal that has only n, little n non-zeros, what is the number of the frequencies from which we can reconstruct our signal? And of course, we'll connect this problem back to the restricted asymmetry condition and try to establish the restricted asymmetry condition of the matrix used. Right, so this is our Fourier reconstruction problem. There should not be any star. Kandes and Tao consequence of their restricted asymmetry condition would be that we would like to reconstruct our signal as a convex optimization problem. We put it in this form now. It's the same as before. We minimize the L1 norm of signal over all signals that have the same measurements, same frequencies. The main problem is how many measurements do we need to take? How many measurements, capital N, that depend on N and D do we have to take in order to do this? And there are two results, two basic results in the field. One is by Kandes, Schomburg, and Tao. That is a non-uniform result, which means that it works for every signal f, every fixed signal f, with hyperbole, but not for all signals. And it is best possible. It's indeed the dream that we put before, that only the linearly many measurements, n times log d, random Fourier frequencies, will be sufficient for exact recovery. The question is open for the uniform result. It is not known if this number of measurements is sufficient to reconstruct uniformly. Namely, if you want to prove that with high probability you can reconstruct, so with high probability the set of frequencies is good to reconstruct every sparse signal, that is harder. The signal is now not fixed. There are too many signals. So this uniform result, the best uniform result would be, again, n times log d, but it is not known. It's only known n times to the power 4 is hyperbolic. There are deep reasons. Okay, no. So what is sufficient to prove in order to establish the uniform result is the restricted asymmetry condition. If we show that our random rows of the discrete Fourier matrix form a restricted asymmetry, then the Kandes and Tao restricted asymmetry theorem will immediately imply the uniform result, because the Kandes Tao result is not probabilistic. It's just whenever you have your matrix right, whenever it is a restricted asymmetry, it will be okay. It will be work nicely. It will work nicely for all the signals at once, so it will give a uniform result. So in order to establish the uniform result, we need to understand what are minors, random rows of the discrete Fourier transform. And again, the results that are known as Kandes and Tao result with n to the power log 6 or log 5 to the d with different probability. And another result, the best known result is n to the log to the power 4. So, but the conjecture again is n times log d. There is a deep reason that I believe this problem is it should be hard to improve beyond log d times log log d. And the deep reason is that assume that you prove that without any logarithmic factor, which is false actually, but if you are going to prove it without any logarithmic factors, then you solve one of the hardest problems in mathematics in the 20th century, which is lambda one conjecture harmonic analysis related to the result of Erdős. And this shows, so this is conjecture that a set AN of for one infinity of integers contains arbitrarily long arithmetic progressions if the sum of 1 over AN diverges. This is one of the hardest conjectures ever known. Nothing is known about this conjecture except that this is true for the primes. So for the primes, this diverges, but that's not hard to show. And if this conjecture is true, it immediately implies that primes contain arbitrary long arithmetic progressions, which is due to Green and Tao. So if this result held without logarithmic factor, it would imply this conjecture. Now it's false without log. Now even if it held with log d, it will improve the best known result of lambda one conjecture by Bourguignon and Talbot, who proved it was log d log log d. So there is a deep harmonic analysis problem under here, and it's not known how to do anything beyond that. Okay, so this is the current state of the art, and so we're going to show this to try to see how I'm going to work with random frequencies to develop basic tools to work with them. So we sample n frequencies of a signal. How do we do that? By means of a matrix. This is our DFT. This is D by D. We take n random rows, which will form our random set omega. This will be our frequencies. Correspond to our frequency. Multiply them by the signal. So if we want to say something about this matrix, and what we want to say is that this matrix forms a restricted isometry, then the first thing we need to know is how do we sample in matrices. So now our random, so think of this, what were our random models in the first and second matrix, sub-Gaussian? There, the amount of randomness is much higher than here. The randomness in sub-Gaussian matrix rests in every entry. All of the entries are statistically independent. So to speak, there are n squared sources of randomness, so n squared independent random variables. That helps us. Here, there is much less amount of randomness. This is our deterministic matrix. We start from a deterministic matrix, DFT. There's nothing random about it. And we use only n random, n sources, and bits of randomness to select the correct rows. So it's a completely different sampling strategy. It's also well understood in statistics. It's empirical sampling. You have a fixed pool of the rows, and from this fixed pool you draw some sample. But it will be harder. The central limit theorems are harder in this case. So we need to understand the random sampling in matrices, which will be actually interesting and useful even beyond this particular area of sparse recoupling. So how do we do that? We need to find the corresponding law of large numbers of central limit theorems for sampling in matrices. And let's go back and review usual law of large matrices, classical one, probability theory. It states that empirical averages over the pool will converge to the true averages. If you're going to learn, so let's have that. So if if you have a random variable x, and you want to learn what's the expectation of random variable x, what is the most likely outcome, you draw independent copies, you sample independent copies, n of them. You want to minimize this number. So you draw independent samples and hope that the empirical mean, that their average over n, will be a nice approximation to the true average. This is your statistic, this is your experiment, this is a true average which you do not know. And the central, and the law of large numbers indeed tells you that this approximation is good in the limit. And there are non-asymptotic results as well. So how good is it? This is the law of large numbers in a non-asymptotic form. It is simple, we'll actually prove it. So this is our deviation of the empirical mean from the true mean, and on average, the deviation is bounded by 1 divided by the square root of n. The factor is stands for standard deviation of x. If you toss coin n times, then the number of heads minus the number of tails is expected to be root of n. Okay, so we'll prove this in order to prove the same thing for matrices. So that we'll use for sampling in matrices. How do we do that? How do we prove this? Well, the problem is that there are general random variables xk, and we want them to, we now want xk to be of the simplest form, and the simplest random variables will be plus or minus one, Bernoulli random variables. For Bernoulli, everything will be nice. And there is a general technique in probability theory, a trick that allows you to, in many contexts, in this context in particular, to replace arbitrary random variables by plus or minus ones. The trick is called symmetrization. It works like this. Instead of one xk, you consider its independent copy, xk prime. And you interpret this difference, well, you interpret this expectation as the expectation of another empirical sample. Do you see that? Okay. So let's see. That is not right. Here should be the expectation. So the expected average. The expectation of this should be the same as the expectation of x because they're independent. Now you can pull this expectation outside by only increasing the norm, or increasing the quantity. If there is an expectation inside here, you can pull the expectation outside by only increasing. This is Jensen's inequality. So it's not exactly equal, but it's less than equal to. Okay. So you do the symmetrization, and now you end up with instead of 1xk, you have xk minus xk prime. What do you win now is that xk minus xk prime is a symmetric random variable. It means that if you flip a sign, it will be distributed the same as before. So xk minus xk prime is distributed the same way as xk prime minus xk, because they are completely changeable. And as a consequence, it is distributed exactly the same as Bernoulli times itself. So you can throw in an extra plus or minus one random variable. Okay. So this is a symmetrization. So we can automatically put an extra Bernoulli random variable inside here. This is it. And then split the sum in two, as before, to separate the two. Use Chandler inequality and bound it by itself. So what do we win now? We put an extra Bernoulli random variable inside. It is independent. So epsilon k is independent from xk. And now we can condition on xk, condition on the choice of xk, fix it, freeze it. It's now no longer random. The only randomness will remain in the Bernoullis, period. So we switched from arbitrary xk's now to just Bernoulli epsilon k's with these weights. So we replaced epsilon k by xk. And now we think of xk as being fixed. We need to control its expectation over the random signs. And this is called Hinchin inequality. It's classical inequality in the 30s, put by Hinchin, which shows that all the moments of this random variable, some plus or minus ak, for whatever number is ak, all these moments are roughly equivalent to each other, and therefore to the second moment. And the second moment equals the sum of ak squared. So here is pth moment, here is second moment. And all the moments are equivalent within some constants bp and ap, which depend only on p. Actually, bp is squared with p. If you're interested in these exact constants, also the exact constants are known. The best constants, Hinchin. So with Hinchin inequality, we just directly apply it to the sum. And condition on xk, so xk is no longer random. Only randomness in the Bernoullis. Apply Hinchin inequality, bounded by the second moment, which is this. And now we unfix xk. Now we remember that they are random again. And taking the expectation of this, we will move expectation inside by only increasing the quantity by whatever inequality it is, Minkowski. And the expectation of each xk square is the same, because they are all identically distributed, and we get the right-hand side as explained. Okay. So the trick was to replace one xk by the symmetric version, and since it is symmetric, we can introduce abstract Bernoulli, and forget about this and work only with Bernoulli. This trick is called symmetrization. In many contexts, it allows you again to replace arbitrary random variable by Bernoulli random variable. So this is a proof of Lower's large numbers. It's non-asymptotic version. And now we need to understand how to sample in matrices. Now we no longer have reals, but we have matrices. We have a big matrix, Fourier matrix, and we sample random rows. And our job will be harder a little bit, because now we sample from matrices, so we sample linear operators rather than reals, and we need the law of large number for operators. And it exists indeed, and this is called the non-commutative law of large numbers, and there is a whole theory, non-commutative geometry or non-commutative analysis, that tries to replace reals with linear operators, going back to von Neumann. So here's the setting again. We have our random operator, and we want to learn the expectation of a random operator, its mean, by drawing sample, as a sample of n independent copies. Statistical problem. We sample random linear operator n times, by looking at only these n linear operators, we want to learn our original operator, which is hidden from us. And of course, what else can we do than approximate the expectation with the empirical expectation? And the problem is, how good is this approximation in the operator? So what else can we do? Just do brute force and try to force this scalar argument, real value, low flash numbers, to work. Just repeat that proof, basically. And let's see. Let's try to repeat it. So this operator is everywhere. The norm, the absolute value, is now operator norm. So we pick an independent copy. We want to symmetrize, so we pick an independent copy. This will all work. The expectation, we pull it outside. This is symmetric again, in the best meaning of this term. And then symmetrize, throw in an extra Bernoulli, and get it down to this form. So symmetrization works just literally. Okay? Now we condition on xk, and the randomness remains in the Bernoulli. So there is no longer random linear operators, only the Bernoulli. The operators are no longer random. But here's a big problem. What's Hinchin inequality? Now, ak's are linear operators, not random, but still linear operators, not reals. Not scalars, and this is operator norm. So what is Hinchin inequality for linear operators? And This was a big problem for some time. It was not known. Okay. So what we do need is a Kinchin inequality for linear operators. It exists, but unfortunately it exists in not in the linear operator in the operator norm, but in Schatten class norm, not in other another norm on linear operators. I'll tell you in a minute what it is. So Schatten class, it consists of all the operators on n-dimensional space, but the norm is computed a little bit differently than the operator norm. For the operator norm, you just pick the largest singular value. That will be the operator norm. For Schatten class, you sum them up rather than picking the biggest one. So the Schatten class, it is a statistics of all the singular values, takes into account all singular values from one to the last one, and sums them up in the little P norm. So for p equal infinity, we have a max of these, and this is an operator norm. For p equal 2, this is a Frobenius or Hilbert-Schmidt norm, which sum the squares of the singular values. And in between, you have a Schatten class. It's a generalization of both operator and Hilbert-Schmidt or Frobenius norms, which are Polish. Okay? So this is the LP norm of the singular values. And of course, we can estimate it by the operator norm. The operator norm is smaller than the Schatten class norm, certainly, because the operator norm only has one of these, and this is the sum of all of them. So the left-hand side is good. The right-hand side is also true because we can estimate each by the maximum of them. And there are n of them, which will raise to the 1 over p. So up to the factor n to the 1 over p, the Schatten class norm is equivalent to the operator norm. And in particular, if p is logarithm n, log n, then there will be truly equivalent, because n to the power 1 over p for p equal log n will be a constant. And so this is the background of Schatten norm. So one thing you should remember about Schatten norm is that it is equivalent to the operator norm when p is log n. And this is not bad. Log n is not bad. Okay. So what is Kinchin inequality then? Here's the Kinchin inequality proved by Luz Picard. Actually, the right-hand side is Luz Picard. And the left-hand side is Luz Picard Vizier. And this is a version of it. We have a self-adjoint. So for any self-adjoint operators AK, and for p bigger than 2, we have the Kinchin inequality, except that the operator norm is replaced by Schatten class norm. There should be no reverse inequality. First, I didn't put this. Now, the operators do not have to be self-adjoint, actually. I mean, if you go to the reference in my notes by PZA, there is a version for non-self-adjoint operators. Very general, very arbitrary. There is a version for p between 1 and 2, so the theory is well-developed. All the constants are now known explicitly. So the best constants here are known for both classical and Kinchin. Don't remember they are the same in the classical, and this they're actually the same constants. So, okay, and of course you can move from the Schatten class norm, which seems ugly, to the operator norm, which we like more, because they're equivalent. Just take p equals log n. You remember for p equals log n that they're equivalent. You'll pay by an extra log factor here. But that's okay. Because remember that the constant depends, it's the root of p, and p will be log n. Still, it's a little price for the operator norm version. Okay? So this is our Kinchin inequality. And we just apply this Kinchin inequality directly to bound to prove the law of large numbers for random operators. Here is a theorem. Both large number of random operators. We'll prove it in a minute. And so the theorem states that if you have a random operator, X self-adjoint, positive self-adjoint operator. Actually, it's not really need positivity and self-adjointness work details. So if you have an operator and take independent copies, then you can learn the expectation of an operator from the empirical expectation in a very nice way. You will pay with a rule of log n. But the right-hand side will be almost the same, except that sigma x will no longer state for the standard deviation, but maximum operator, maximum operator norm. This is random operator x. It's a little bit larger than the standard deviation. I could not work it to the, I did not know this holds actually for the standard deviation.
Not sure.
But the price for the operator norm, what differs this from Kinchin inequality, this root of log n is essential. The root of log n is actually optimal. And the standard deviation, sigma x, will be replaced by this bound, like L infinity L1 bound, which is typically larger than L2 L2, which is standard deviation. Okay. So law of large numbers, so let's prove this. How do you do that? So again, you do this symmetrization. You throw an extra plus or minus ones. You now condition on the choice of linear of the random operator. So the only randomness now rests in the Bernoullis, and you apply Kinchin inequality. You pay with the log n factor, and this is the right hand side of Kinchin inequality. And now we unfix xk fact. Once we're done with that, we unfix xk, remember that they are random, so we put the expectation outside. And we need to bound this. There's a little problem here that we cannot just move expectation inside the norm by increasing the value. Something that we did with in the scalar case, we just move expectation inside this bracket here, this parenthesis, by increasing the value. But that's not true. Here, you do a little trick, basically. You relate, so what you do is, you take this expectation, and so move 1/2 to the power here, because of the positivity and self-adjointness, it's true. And then you take one of the xk, so you split the square in two. Take one of them out, like here, bam. And the expectation, and the sum will be sum of xk's. And now what's interesting here is that you relate the sum of xk's to the original quantity. Because originally you wanted the sum of xk. This is our empirical mean. When you do these things right, I'll not do this exactly. You do this thing to the end, this little algebra, here inside you'll be back with your original quantity, the empirical mean. So you have your deviation e, which you bound by something that also contains e. What saves you is that e here comes with power 1, and here is power 1/2, so you solve this inequality and get the average. So for now you may safely forget this trick. The main thing is the symmetrization of Kinchin inequality, and then whatever takes you to beat things to the end. So symmetrization of Kinchin inequality will prove the law of large numbers for random operators. You have now this powerful tool, law of large numbers for random operators. Now we're back to our situation with sampling from random matrices, or Fourier matrix, we sample random rows, and we want to say, when is this sample restrictively symmetry? Turns out it could not be done immediately from law of large numbers, but instead we will do a little detour through frame theory, which will also be outside of this context as well. So I'll do a little review on the frames, which is an important topic in computational harmonic analysis, and interpret the restricted symmetry conditions in the frames, and then get that'll be here. So frames is a generalization of orthogonal bases. Some of you know what it is. It's a system of vectors in Hilbert space that satisfies Parseval's. This is Parseval's inequality. Xk are your vectors. The inner product with x, if you sum the squares, must be the same as the norm of x squared. This Parseval's inequality. If this holds, the system is called a frame. So certainly, orthogonal bases satisfy Parseval's inequality, therefore they are a frame. But there are more than that. So what differs, what is missing actually? Why the frames are not bases then, if they satisfy Parseval's?
Exactly,
yes. Linear independence is missing, exactly. Yeah. So linear independence is missing. We do not require the frame to be linearly independent. So if you repeat the orthogonal basis 10 times, and normalize it properly, it will still form a frame. This will be an uninteresting frame, though. It will not contain any more information than the original basis. And an interesting example of the frame will be when you have a orthogonal basis outside in a bigger space and project it orthogonal into a smaller dimensional space. You may as well have got orthogonal base repeated 10 times if you choose this projection in a clever way. But in most of the cases, you will have just some projection, like these three vectors in two-dimensional plane are obviously projection of the orthogonal bases. Just view it from right perspective. So this will be a frame. And actually, this characterizes all the frames. Every frame can be obtained by a projection from a higher dimension space of an orthogonal basis. Okay? And another characterization of the frame is that you can write the identity operator in terms of the frame elements. So this tensor product, which may scare you a little bit, first sight, is simply a rank one linear operator that acts in a specific way. So this operator, how does it act on x? It is xk times x, and then times xk. So this is the action. So what this identity, the decomposition of the identity tells you is that every x can be represented like in your usual orthogonal basis form. This is basic coefficients times xk. You do have this, but do not necessarily have linear independence, you have a frame. It's an equivalent condition. And this is actually a tight frame because it's exact equality. You may relax it a little bit and say epsilon tight frames, if all the equations hold up to epsilon in the property. So this is concept of frames, and there is a nice duality for the frames. You can understand them by means of a matrix. If you form a matrix that is an isometry, tall matrix. Isometry means that all of the rows, all of the columns are orthogonal to each other. So the norm of AX equals the norm of X. So if you have an isometry, then the columns will be orthogonal, and the rows will form a frame. It's if and only if. The columns form a tight frame if and only if the rows are the columns.
So what's the definition of the tight frame? You go back?
Tight frame, Parseval's identity, or this.
Okay. So what's not a frame?
What's not a frame? You don't necessarily have exact equality here. Of course, in finite dimensional spaces, you will. If the system is linear, it suspends the whole space, also positive, this will be also positive, but they will not be exactly.
And we have an natural sort of vectors on the not finite space, but the Euclidean space or something that would not be a frame?
Well, yes, this is not a frame. So these two vectors in two dimensional space, or maybe these three vectors in two dimensional space is not a frame. So the duality, so the epsilon tight frames also hold, the duality holds for them. So the rows of the matrix form an epsilon tight frame if and only if A is an almost isometry, which moves us closer to the topic. Here's what we recognize as a restricted isometry. So if you prove that your matrix A is an almost isometry, it's the same as saying that its rows form an almost tight frame. So you can have balance between two worlds, frame world and the restricted isometry. All right. So here comes the Riddleson selection theorem about frames, which we'll later, in view of this condition, put back into restricted isometry perspective. So this is a remarkable theorem that says that if you have a frame with too many elements, then most of them can be removed and the system is still a frame. So the redundancy can be lowered. Of course, the number of frame elements must be at least the dimension of the space in order for the frame to span the whole space. This must hold. And the conjecture, which is still unproved, there's, I don't know of any way that can solve this conjecture, can even be close to this conjecture, is that every tight frame in dimension n, you can remove, so you, from every tight frame, you can remove all of the elements except linearly the dimension and still have an epsilon tight frame. So for every tight frame with possibly huge redundancy, you can remove almost all elements and still have an epsilon tight frame. The number is linear. The number of elements that stay should be linear. Nobody knows how to prove that. But Riddleson selection theorem tells you that this is true up to log factor. For every frame, if you do a random element, a random subset of the frame of size n log n, it will still be a good frame, epsilon tight frame. The C of epsilon is actually 1 over epsilon squared. So everything is known about that. And Riddleson selection theorem is particularly nice, even if conjecture is proved, because it shows that the selection is random. And log n is actually needed for random subsets. This is why this conjecture is hard. We do not know any other way to select them randomly. For the random selection, log n is needed. This is Riddleson selection theorem. And the remarkable feature of this is that it is independent of the number of frame, of the number of frame elements. You can start with millions of frame elements, much bigger than n, and the selection theorem, the conclusion of the selection theorem only takes into account the dimension of the space, but not the number of original frame elements. For example, your frame may be just continuum. You must interpret the sum in the proper way. All the questions is here. Okay, it's a selection. And so here's the right statement of Riddleson selection theorem. If you have a tight frame, pick an epsilon, then you choose an n-element subset by selecting each element independently, but you must choose it right, that each element will come with probability proportional to its contribution to the frame. And the contribution is measured in terms of the Euclidean norm. Maybe some frame elements are negligible. You can, of course, if you have a frame, you can add a little bit of every of many small elements around zero, which will still form an epsilon tight frame. But then selection theory will tell you, no, you should not pick those with high probability. All right, so then with high probability, a subset of n log n elements form an epsilon tight frame, properly normalized. Normalization is simple. You just normalize the frame elements and put a normalization factor. Should not worry too much about this factor yet. So we'll see how it works. All right, so let's prove the Riddleson selection theorem. So since it's a tight frame, we have this representation, frame representation. Identity can be represented as a tensor product. So identity acting on X is represented as tensor product acting on X. This is this representation. And if you take the trace of both sides, you will see that the sum of this norms of XK squared equals M. That's a fact that's true for all tight frames. Now the remarkable thing here is to change the perspective. So instead of viewing this as the operator identity, you will view this as a probabilistic identity. So you introduce probability by looking at this as an expectation of a random linear operator. So what's a random linear operator? First, fix the probabilities. So here's the probabilities. And normalize our elements with these probabilities. And rewrite this identity with these probabilities and normalization. I'll tell you later why we need these probabilities. So this will be expectation of a random operator that has these values, takes values, these, right? With these probabilities pk. Interesting. You just interpret this as expectation of a random linear operator. For now, you may think that we choose pk's arbitrarily. Just choose some pk, some probabilities. It'll be extra handy to pull up. And the probability is actually chosen so that the contribution of each value of this operator is almost the same. by the normalization, by this normalization, the norm of xk bar is root of n equals the square root of n. Okay? So, all right, so what we do, so we have a random operator x. Here's a random operator x taking these values with these probabilities. The norm, so it's always bounded because the values will have norms at root of n. So we have a random operator, takes these values, expectation is identity. Its expectation is identity. This is a random operator. And now we apply the law of large numbers to this operator. It's very interesting thing that you look at this analytic term as a probabilistic, in a probabilistic way, as an expectation of a random linear operator. Then you just apply law of large numbers and it works. So basically what you do now is you sample identity, and you get the identity, obviously. And then you sample this linear operator n times, and you will, with the outcome, you'll get some xk, but possibly not all of xk's. And still in the end, law of large numbers tell you that the empirical samples will be the same, almost the same. But in the empirical sample, you will have much fewer elements than all of the elements in the frame. And that's how the rules are sort of experience. Okay, so this is how it works. We just check that the variance, the standard deviation, is the square root of n, is the algebra, and apply the law of large numbers. This is the right-hand side of large numbers. This is our price for operating norm, root of log n times the whatever square root of n. So this will be the right-hand side, and we want this to be small. And of course, if we choose the number of elements, the sample complexity, the number of elements we pick from the frame, bigger than n log n, will make this term smaller than epsilon. And now we recall what was our xj. Our xj was the empirical sample of our operator k, but the operator x. And our operator x takes this frame elements, xk times xk. So it's just an empirical sample of our frame elements. That means that, we approximate identity with the sum of xkj tensor xkj, which is the condition for an epsilon tight frame. So we do have an epsilon tight frame there. So basically, Rudolphson selection theorem is just a law of large numbers applied when you view the frame identity in a probabilistic way. And here is a conclusion of everything, how you apply it to Fourier measurements and to restricted assumptions. So what is our original goal? We have a DFT, a discrete Fourier transform matrix, or any orthogonal matrix with bounded entries. We sample rows randomly, n rows, and we want to prove that this selection of rows, that phi, is a restricted isometry, which means that every submatrix Pt, every minor with n columns is an epsilon isometry. This is a restricted isometry condition on matrix phi, that every minor should be an epsilon isometry. Let's fix the minor, fix T. So we're going to show that this matrix shown in dashed lines will be almost isometry. How do you do that? Well, we use frames. We use frame duality. This matrix being an epsilon isometry means that its rows form an epsilon tight frame. Remember that? So if and only if. So the matrix is an epsilon isometry if and only if its columns form an epsilon tight frame. That's a duality, the frame duality. So we want to show that the columns here, the rows here form an epsilon tight frame. That's our goal. How are you going to show that? Well, we know what the rows are. The rows here are a random sample of all the rows, of all the rows of the DFT matrix, restricted to T. So these rows are a random sample of this rows. And what are these rows? These are frame. This is a tight frame. It's just because the columns here are exactly orthogonal. This is even only if the rows are tight frame. So we have a tight frame out of which we pick a random subset and want to say if the random whether the random set is an epsilon tight frame. And the Riddle's and Swenson theorem answer is positive. Yes, it's positive. It's an epsilon tight frame. Provided that you have a number that your sample n is n times log n, which matches the spirit of sparse approximation theory with n dimensions, so almost linear in dimension. And so we prove there is strictly symmetry this way. And the only unfortunate feature of this is that this does not prove there is strictly symmetry yet, because this is for fixed t, for fixed minor. And there are exponentially many of them. And this is too bad, because the probability actually will be polynomial if you do this, which is quite usual because the sampling is done this way. So how to unfix t is not easy, and we're not doing this. So we want to handle all t at once. And this is done in two papers in Kandestau and in Drudels and myself. Unfixing t is a hard job. The reason, again, is connection to the lambda 1 conjecture, the lambda p conjecture. Kandestau work follows the argument, follows the spirit of the argument of Bourdain, of the solution of the lambda p conjecture, and ours uses a little bit softer technique. But still, this is where our current losses of logarithmic factors are. This is where the deepest part of the theory rests, because without it, we will just have n times log n or log d. So we covered two ways to generate random matrices. Complete independence, every entry is independent, that's sort of easier case. Have Gaussian matrices for which everything is known explicitly. You just need to know where the literature is. So all the singular values are known, and you can read them. Sub-Gaussian matrices are much harder, and the conjecture, there is a conjecture that the asymptotic theory for sub-Gaussian matrices should always match the non-asymptotic theory. That's a conjecture. So this covers Bernoulli case as well. And the hardest of all is Fourier measurements, where you sample from a deterministic pool. So you have n square elements, and out of them you sample this, and